potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films 50 Shades Freed, Peter Rabbit, Happy End, The Cloverfield Paradox, and the Oscar-nominated short films. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring War of the Worlds, the complete series. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news, there's a Quentin Tarantino story with Uma Thurman. This is what is dovetailing after the Me Too movement. In terms of entertainment, there's some Me Too blowback that's happening in national news, dealing with abuse and that sort of thing. That's not movie news. Let's talk the movie news, though. This is what you're getting that's kind of a precursor to the post Me Too movement, and it is not necessarily that you're directly harassed or assaulted. There was a report that Uma Thurman came out and said that in addition to skeezy behavior for Harvey Weinstein, which everybody knew was happening, there was discussion of Quentin Tarantino and him being overly aggressive when they did a scene in Kill Bill, that she ended up being in a car crash and she wasn't comfortable doing it and she felt bullied, but then she kind of came back and said she doesn't blame Tarantino, and Tarantino responded. This is what ends up happening. And it's a natural progression of things. You're going to get something that's explosive, like in the Me Too movement of Harvey Weinstein and basically running a sex ring with his actresses and then going after him with the company's money, all the way down to, you know, just people saying creepy things on set, or James Franco, what's happened with James Franco, where people are like, oh, well, he just wanted me to do a nude scene because he wanted to see my breasts. Well, there's a nude scene. If there's a nude scene in a movie, I mean, then it starts to get very equivocal at a certain point. The next step is going after abusers and people who are doing things and basically treating women without respect. Look, there's nothing new for a director to want something more than can be safely achieved by the actors at hand. There's a fantastic story out there back in the late 80s of James Cameron directing The Abyss, and ultimately having Ed Harris almost drown in the process because he was such a perfectionist. And yes, was that dangerous to James Cameron? Yes, does this happen? But that happened in the 80s, and there's always stories of this. And hey, look what happened with John Landis on the set of Twilight Zone, where Vic Morrow actually lost his life due to unsafe explosions in an action set piece. This is not a male or female thing, because like I said, you had James Cameron almost kill Ed Harris, and you had Vic Morrow actually get killed on the set of Twilight Zone. What's going on with Uma Thurman and the Tarantino wanting to do a more dangerous stunt, that's filmmaking. And it's getting a little bit of attention because she's a woman, and she was a hot actress at the time, and she was dealing with Harvey Weinstein stuff at the time. But this is no defense of Quentin Tarantino, because he kind of seems like a jerk himself in general, or even a defense of James Cameron, or John Landis for that matter. But these are things that happen on movie sets that have nothing to do with the sex of the person in the role. It has to do with the director wanting to achieve a vision, and he may not have the safest thing in order. That's why you have unions and a stunt coordinator, and you have people who are supposed to be in charge of the safety. And we had something like that happen, a year and a half ago, where a stunt person did get killed by a train. Vampire in Brooklyn, a Wes Craven movie from the 90s, starring Eddie Murphy. A woman died, a stunt woman died. You're in at-risk moments when you're doing stunts. And does this dovetail into the Me Too movement? I think the reason this got most attention is because it was a Harvey Weinstein production and it had Uma Thurman, who kind of fit the serial approach of Harvey Weinstein for actresses in the 90s. It was a movement that exploded and it's trying to continue and live, but it may not be uncovering what it needs to uncover to have longevity. The movement has a lot of teetering legs. The other piece of news that I think is interesting, let's talk about this one, is the Game of Thrones showrunners have been tapped to do a new Star Wars trilogy. Now, as you know, you had Rian Johnson, who did The Last Jedi. He gets a new trilogy. This guy's going to get a new trilogy. People are saying, well, where are the women? Why can't women direct it? Where are the people of color? Why can't people of color direct it? They're picking people who have track records, and that's fine. And I actually had this, somebody asked me this about the Oscar nominations, about, well, you know, is, you know, should there be more women nominated? And I think the bigger problem is women aren't getting the directing opportunities. Yeah, you had Patty Jenkins, but she's, you know, and then this is going to take time to cycle through because everyone wants a track record. And, you know, yeah, you had Greta Gerwig directing Lady Bird and getting an Oscar nomination. You had Jordan Peele directing Get Out and getting an Oscar nomination. But they're the exception to the rule right now. And you just need to give them more opportunities. And yes, then the nominations will come. Ultimately, the showrunners, a lot of showrunners are guys, and that's what you're going to get. And especially for a tentpole release, like, you know, they're talking about doing a whole trilogy, not talking about doing one little standalone film. And so if people are beating their drum on Film Twitter saying you need to have more women direct, and that's fine. But you're going to start seeing that in the spinoff movies. Like you had Rogue One, now you have Solo, and now people are backlashing against that, going, we don't want to see more stuff about Han Solo. We don't want to see more stuff about Obi-Wan Kenobi or Boba Fett. We want to see new stuff. Well, you are seeing new stuff. We're only 3 years into having these movies. We've only had three of them released so far. It took Marvel 4 years to get to Avengers, and then another year or two to get to something really innovative like Guardians of the Galaxy. So give the Star Wars is taking the approach that the ancillary properties like role-playing games and comic books and novels took in the 90s. And that's taking some time. You started off with the Timothy Zahn books, The Heir to the Empire, then the Kevin J. Anderson books, and then they started to really spread out and you had characters that weren't named Skywalker involved. But it takes some time to get people used to seeing Star Wars. I don't think Star Wars is going to wane in terms of interest. You may have ups and downs in box office, but they're still, Disney knows what it's doing. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Speaking of Star Wars, let's play the new Solo trailer. We finally got a trailer for this one. See what this movie might look like.
I've been running scams on the street since I was 10. I was kicked out of Flight Academy for having a mind of my own. I'm going to be a pilot.
Hey, kid, I'm putting together a crew. You in?
That's yes.
This is, of course, an extended version of what played during the Super Bowl. It was one of the big movie release trailers, which was a fantastic look at the thing. I think this looks a lot like Rogue One in a lot of ways. And I think that's great. I like them filling the gaps, giving a backstory. And I know there's people who don't like it and they say, oh, we need to have a Star Wars movie without the Millennium Falcon in it. That's okay. Nostalgia still works. And they've got plenty of new stuff in this movie. And I'm looking to see where this goes. Like I said, this is doing what the comic books and the role-playing games and the novels were doing long before they even made the prequels. That one comes out on May 25th. Now, the next one is Mission Impossible Fallout. That opens on July 27th.
You had a terrible choice to make in Berlin. One life over millions. And now the world is at risk.
This is the CIA's mission. If he had held on to the plutonium, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
You don't understand what you're involved in.
You need to walk away.
Please don't make me go through you.
How many times has Hunt's government betrayed him, disavowed him, cast him aside? How long before a man like that has had enough?
I love the Mission Impossible movies. I think they're really exciting and they're well done, and they certainly have a good feel and look. I like the fact they're bringing Rebecca Ferguson back into this one, and I love the fact that they kind of give a wink and a nod to the fact that Ethan Hunt's been burned so many times by the U.S. This one looks like it follows the stride that was hit during Ghost Protocol. It's probably not going to be a huge moneymaker. It's not going to be as big as Star Wars, but that's okay. As long as it makes the money that these Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movies make, I'm happy for. So yes, this summer looks like it might be an interesting time. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Peter Rabbit and Happy End. We'll be right back. back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews with the first film of the week that I want to talk about, and that is Peter Rabbit. James Corden voices the lovable Beatrix Potter's children's book character, a rabbit whose family tries to coexist with humans, particularly a grumpy man protecting his vegetable garden.
Rabbits are generous, honest, pure, graceful creatures.
Blue jacket, no pants, you must be Peter Rabbit.
Yeah, that's right.
I can't think of one thing that could stop our fun.
Checking on a new neighbor. I'll explain it to him. We'll share our land around here.
I just need to keep the wildlife out where they belong.
It's been quite a few years since I've read a Peter Rabbit book. And I actually had read a handful of them. I actually used to work in a library. And in the library where I worked, it was a small library. I mean, it was, I don't know, it was maybe the size of two suburban houses. And had an upstairs and downstairs. So it wasn't a very large library. But in this library, downstairs was the juvenile books, and everything from picture books up to middle grade fiction. So when you got a job there as a page, they started you out in the children's department putting books away. And you'd get books to return, they put on a cart, and they bring the cart into the workroom. And you'd have to sort the cart. Now, you always had to pace your work in such a way that you didn't want to put your books away too quickly, because then if you went to your boss and said, I don't have anything to do, they'd find you something to do, which is usually awful. So I started out in the juvenile department, and we'd sit there and we'd sort the books, and then we'd take them out and put them away, and we'd come back, and Mondays were very busy, so we usually had to do more work. But if you're there on a Thursday, nobody was returning books on a Thursday, so you're lucky if you had one cart. And so you kind of had to make that stretch. And so we'd sit there, and as we're putting the books away, we'd read the books, especially kids' books, because, you could read a picture book in a couple minutes. So I read some of the Peter Rabbit books then, and I remember it was very charming. I mean, Peter Rabbit is very charming. It's very British, and it's very squeaky clean. If there's anything I remember, it's very nice. If you're a parent and you've watched kid shows, and I'm not talking about Nickelodeon, I'm talking about Nick Jr. or Noggin back in the day, when you had TV shows like Maisie and Oswald and Ubi and those very nice stuff that nothing ever happens. I mean, the most, Little Bear was the edgiest thing that they had. And it reminded me, these Beatrix Potter books reminded me of the stuff that went on Noggin. It was all very nice, no real danger. Like I said, it's been decades since I've read these, so I don't know them by heart, but they were very sweet and charming, nice ones. I think there was a lot less fart humor in the original books than it gets in this movie. And not to poke fun at fart humor or to fixate on it, I'm a big fan of body humor. I'm a huge fan of that. But I also recognize that this is not the highest brow of humor. And I think what happened is they said, even people know who Peter Rabbit is if you've never read the book. And you kind of recognize this iconic image of this rabbit in a blue coat. And they do a great job making the animals look like the animals from the book in the original drawings. But I'm sure that there was the moment where they all sat down in the studio and said, we have to make it right for kids. So it needs to be goofy. It needs to be crazy. It needs to be plain modern pop music, and they got to dance, and we got to get a new guy that you can't just have somebody come and do. You got James Corden doing the voice, and he's a little bit edgy, and a little bit of fart humor is good because kids love fart humor. Let's do that. And that's kind of how I feel they pitched this. And then instead of telling the sweet little stories of the rabbits, they then have to, we need to have humans, because they do that in movies. They did that. Remember the Muppets? They did the Muppet movie several years ago, and they said, we can't have it be about the Muppets. Let's get Jason Segel and Amy Adams, because people are going to want to see them. Nobody cares about Kermit the Frog, And so I think then they brought in Rose Byrne to play the character's Bee. So I think she's kind of like the character of Beatrix Potter, because she paints pictures of the rabbits. And then they bring in Domhnall Gleeson, who of course did the Winnie the Pooh movie a couple months ago, but he comes in and he's the frustrated, Mr. Wilson from Dennis the Menace kind of character, where, he doesn't like the rabbits and the woodland animals coming into his house or into his yard. It fits the archetype you'd expect, but I don't know how close to the original book these stories were. I recall the book being these sweet little stories of just the rabbits' lives, but of course there's this adversarial Mr. Wilson, Dennis the Menace kind of relationship that gets weirdly violent at times. The rabbits are strangely okay with murder in multiple scenes. they're either attempting murder or they straight up kill somebody. And that's kind of an odd thing to put in a kid's movie. And then at one point, like, there's actually a scene that happens. And then they're kind of like, oh, well, you know, I mean, within 15 minutes, the rabbits commit murder. And then they commit, like, attempted murder multiple times in the movie that is, like, that's the problem with cartoons versus photorealism. When you have a movie like this, you know, if you have somebody explode in a cartoon, you know, it's like Daffy Duck with his bill goes to the back of his head. But in real life, in a photo, you don't want to do a photorealistic thing where somebody gets their jaw blown around to the back of their head. That's just gruesome. So I don't know. I think there was a missed opportunity here. I think they wanted Paddington, but they also wanted to go like, we want to go mainstream. We want to do what the kids like nowadays. So there's fart jokes and there's music and dancing, and it just doesn't fit. It's at times it's very Peter Rabbit and sometimes it's very much not. And then even at sometimes there's this weird absurdity there because there's rabbits dressed up in little coats and are able to manipulate things and move things around. And you have B in the movie saying, oh, they're just rabbits. Well, are you, how dumb are you? They're in clothes and then they speak, but do they really speak or do they speak to themselves? And that stuff is, it's almost like they couldn't make a decision and they wanted it both ways. And so. Yeah, the kids might like the slapstick and fart humor, but I don't think it makes for a great movie. So Peter Rabbit kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about Happy End really quickly. This is by Michael Haneke. He's an Academy Award-winning director who he did movies like Amour, and he did Funny Games. I'm not a fan, so preface that. There's also no trailer because most of the movie's in French. A girl with unsettling problems goes to live with her estranged extended family after her mother mysteriously falls ill and dies. This is very typical Michael Haneke because it's very dark and it's very twisted and it's very grim. If you remember, he did the movie Amour and that was okay, but this just deals with dark characters. But it does it in the most boring way. It's just a bunch of people sitting around talking to each other. And if you love that sitting around talking to each other, those kitchen sink dramas where there's no action anywhere, it's all just revealed in dialogue, yeah, you might like that, but there's not a lot of oomph to it. And Haneke does these things where he's a big, long, drawn-out scenes. Like there's one scene of a guy in a wheelchair, he's going down the road, he talks to these guys on the street. It just takes forever and it does nothing. And there's another scene where one of the characters is dancing in front of a window. I mean, like for 10 minutes, I think I dozed off and woke up and I'm like, oh, he's still dancing. You know, I did not like this movie. I did not like what it had to say. I found it insipid and boring, but very much like Michael Haneke. So if you're a huge fan of Michael Haneke, I don't even know if I'm saying his name right. I interviewed the guy once and I asked him a critical question about his movie. And he got mad at me because it was about his movie Funny Games. And I asked him, because he made a remake of American Remake, almost a shot by shot. But at that time, some technology had changed. And I asked him about why he didn't fix the technology gaffe. And he got mad at me because he thought he did when he really didn't. So I'm not a huge fan. And I'm going to have to say that Happy End, while for the right person, they may love it. I think it sucked.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about 50 Shades Freed and the Oscar Shorts animation block. Because we can!
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the movie that everyone's talking about, that everybody wants to know. No, it wasn't Peter Rabbit. We talked about that in the last segment. We're going to talk about 50 Shades Freed. The final chapter, the climax, if you will, according to the poster, finds Anastasia and Christian dealing with life as newlyweds when a stalker returns from the past.
Don't ask me.
This is Gray. Look out your window.
What you know is true.
I'm taking you away for the weekend.
I just can't believe this is my life that I get to live with you.
I'll pick you up at 5.
I might not be done by then.
Maria followed. How the hell are you, Anna?
Jack, what do you want?
Do you remember soap operas? I mean, I know there's some that still exist. I guess they still do soap operas on some networks, but the heyday of soap operas, sort of like the 70s and the 80s and into the 90s, those days are long gone. With good riddance, because I thought soap operas were garbage. But back in the 80s, you had Luke and Laura, and they went on the run, and it became this national phenomenon. I remember they did a story in Newsweek. It was a cover story in Newsweek about Luke and Laura. So these sort of things do every now and then catch on. And I wouldn't even call this a romance, because the romance has nothing to do with... Heck, in this movie, it barely even has to do with sex. I hate to spoil it, but there's sex in this movie, but it's boring sex. And the real... taboo stuff that happened in the first film, that was boring in itself. These movies, for as much as they're supposed to be about sex, it's some of the worst sex you're going to see on screen. But the movie itself is meant to sort of wrap things up. And the beginning of the film alternates between scenes of boring sex and preconceived soundtrack montages like Grey's Anatomy. I mean, I swear to God, in the first half hour, they plow through about 15 songs. And then they balance that out with the scenes of them having discussions about things that you should have had discussions about before we got married. Stuff like, are you going to take my last name? Are you going to be a working spouse or are you going to be at home? Do you want kids? I mean, stuff like that that they literally apparently don't even address until after you're married. And, you know, like the kids issue, that's kind of a deciding factor. If you really, really want kids, don't get married to somebody who doesn't want kids. They're not going to change. And then, and there's even like the stuff that like forget stuff that happened in the first movie. I thought that there was a scene in the, like the first movie where they actually cook and he cooks with her. But in this one, apparently he's an incompetent cook, but apparently he can do everything else in the world. And there's a scene where after the wedding, they drive up to a private jet and Anastasia looks at it and goes, do you own all this? And his reply, and it was all done for this reply. No, we own all this. But I'm like, didn't we establish 2 freaking movies ago that this guy's a billionaire who has a mansion and a yacht like Elmer Fudd? There's also this weird underlying sexism with this that should upset women, because Christian Grey has and always continues to say, well, I'm going to be surround myself with beautiful women. You go into his office in the movie and there's gorgeous women working as secretaries and lawyers. And then he has a doctor come out at one point and she's gorgeous. And in this one, they got Ariel Kebble playing his architect and she's gorgeous. But of course, all of them are the best in the world. And I'm sorry, no, you may occasionally find somebody who's gorgeous, who's the best in the world at something like architecture. But because architecture has no bearing on your physical appearance, it is unlikely the best at it is going to be somebody who's gorgeous. Case in point, I remember watching this episode of the TV show The Girls Next Door, which was that one with Hugh Hefner and his girlfriends for several years back in the early 2000s. They go through the Playboy Mansion, and there was his personal secretary was this old woman, not attractive in at all. But I remember looking at that going, I think it's hilarious that he surrounds himself with beautiful women, but for things that really matter, the person who's going to take care of the books, he doesn't care how good you look. He wants you to be good at your job. And that's the thing, that's just this weird underlying sexism that you can't even be in Christian Grey's orbit without being gorgeous. That just, and that's okay for him to do. But boy, if James Franco wants to see somebody's boobs on set for a movie that's going to film that scene, no, that's wrong. It's just weird. I mean, this is not for me. I suppose that, you know, fans are going to like it, but it's terrible. It's accurate to the book. I guess it's probably more accurate than the Beatrix Potter books or Peter Rabbit. The best thing I can say about this movie is at least we're done. It's sort of like, okay, whew, there's not going to be any more of this garbage. But if you went in for this movie because of the taboo BDSM, horny housewife sex element, that's all in the first movie. Although there is, what's funny, I'm going to talk around this. There's a question that Anastasia asks in the first movie that I thought was one of the most hilarious questions she ever asked, because the answer is very self-apparent. Go back and watch the movie. She learns the answer in this movie, and it's absurd because it's something that would be a little more traumatic than how wonderful it was. But like I said, the sex is boring. And if you have some sort of fixation on Jamie Dornan's body hair, they really fixate on that. To me, it's like, You know, it's like hair, like women who have beautiful hair. That's wonderful. I don't want to eat it. It's not my predilection. So, yeah, 50 Shades Freed is pretty awful. It really is. So I'm going to say it totally sucks. But fans will like it.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the 2018 Oscar-nominated short films. These are one of the best things that ever come to the theaters that very few people go and see. And people should make a point to go see them. Now, the live-action stuff and the documentary stuff tends to deal with some very heavy issues. So, yeah, you're going to need to, you know, brace yourself for those. And the documentary stuff, there's usually two blocks. And like in Columbus, Ohio, where I'm from, they have the documentary blocks and the live-action block and the animation block all at the Gateway Film Center, which is an independent theater in town. And I love the fact that they play these every year. Now, you can also get them on Shorts TV, which is online. Just search Oscar-nominated shorts, and you should be able to find it. But I'm going to just focus really quickly on the animation block. Here's a trailer for one of the films, Revolting Rhymes.
What great big ears you have, Grandma.
Fairy stories.
What great big eyes you have, Grandma. But Grandma... What a lovely, great big furry coat you have on.
You think you know these stories. You don't.
I love animation, and I have to say that, like, last year, I wasn't jazzed about animation. I mean, there were some good ones. I mean, Coco was fine, and I thought the Boss Baby was better than I ever expected, and, you know, the Batman, Lego Batman movie was fun. But you didn't have the powerhouse animations that I usually do. Usually animations in my top 10, I at least have one or two of them. That year it wasn't as much. This year, of course, we got a Wes Anderson movie, and, you know, we've got Pixar and DreamWorks are going to be putting some stuff out. We've got an Aardman movie opening very shortly. This year there are five short films up for the animation Oscar. First one's Dear Basketball, which is Kobe Bryant worked with the Disney animator to develop basically his love letter to basketball when he retired. And it's a very sort of sketchy pencil animation version of it. And it's very charming and sweet. I just don't care about basketball. I think it's brilliantly conceived, and it's wonderful that he got this Disney legend to work on it. There's also Lou, which is this charming little thing about this anthropomorphic lost and found blob that comes to life in a playground. It's very Pixar. It's not my favorite Pixar short, but it's cute. Negative Space is a charming story about a son dealing with the relationship with his father in sort of a unique expression. Garden Party is actually my favorite one because it's dark and twisted and weird. And it's about these woodland animals, these like frogs and lizards that take over an abandoned mansion. And you'll find out why if you see the movie. And then finally, Revolting Rhymes, which takes a Roald Dahl story and animates it. The animation's not all that innovative. It's a little bit rustic, but it has some great voices in it. And ultimately, if you get a chance to check these out, they're always great. The animation block's always my favorite. And in the one that plays theatrically, they throw a couple extra shorts in there as well. And I'm going to have to say that the 2018 Oscar-nominated animated short films rock.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Cloverfield Paradox, box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring War of the Worlds.
And the Magnificent!
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, wrapping things up for the show with our final review. I'm not actually reviewing 1517 to Paris, just in case you were wondering. The reason for that is it was not screened widely. It was screened in some markets, but very, very limited. I live in Columbus, Ohio. There were no screenings anywhere in Ohio. I'll check it out, and I'll probably review it next week as an extra film because I think it's worth talking about. But the big thing is that it's Clint Eastwood's latest movie, and it's about this terrorist event that happened and these real-life heroes that got in the way. And the thing is, he casts the real-life heroes in the movie, and I'm wondering if that's kind of part of the problem with it. It reminds me of Act of Valor, that movie about the Navy SEALs several years ago, and they actually got real Navy SEALs to play the parts. that was their gimmick that they got. And I remember seeing interviews where they were talking about saying, oh, well, you know, it was great because they lived through it and they know what it's like and their real emotions, blah, 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 blah. Here's the thing. I love the American military. I have the greatest respect for the American military. God help me if I were overseas in a terrible situation being held against my will, the first people I want coming to get me are the American military. However, if I want somebody to play a role of somebody who's going to come get me in another country held against my will, I'll probably want a Hollywood actor. And that's nothing against the American military. The American military's job is not to emote and control your emotions and do a realistic performance. They're very good at what they're trained at, but they're not trained at acting. So putting them in acting roles is an interesting idea, and it does make a certain level of kitsch to the movie. But I think it was a mistake with Act of Valor. I'm wondering if it's a mistake here. The fact that they didn't screen this doesn't bode well for the movie because it's a Clint Eastwood film. And it should be getting a little more respect. So I'm not covering that this week. But what I am going to cover this week is the Cloverfield Paradox. A mission on a space station opens a dimensional portal that puts our entire reality in danger.
I have to be quick. Whatever you're doing right now, stop. Go to your children right now. Kiss them. Hold them for as long as you can. That's all there is. Right now.
This made the most news because they advertised it during the Super Bowl. There was this teaser ad about 30 seconds, which was part of what you heard just now. And it dropped this trailer and said, hey, this is going to be available on Netflix right after the Super Bowl. And don't you know it? You turned on Netflix right after the Super Bowl. Bam. You could watch the Cloverfield Paradox. This was brilliant marketing. Talk about building buzz and anticipation in such a short amount of time. You got so many people watching the Super Bowl. Plus, there's a lot of movie fans watching it because they wanted to see the Infinity Wars trailer and the Solo trailer and the Mission Impossible trailer and the Jurassic Park trailer. So you already got them interested and they're like, oh my gosh, let me go watch this. And then you just released it. And what's funny is the first Cloverfield movie was always a mystery box movie anyways, because they did a teaser trailer like 6 months ahead. And then this last one that they did, 10 Cloverfield Lane, they only had a month lead and they dropped the trailer out of nowhere because J.J. Abrams was able to sneak it in under Star Wars. And now they've got this one that was literally, an hour or two before it actually premiered? There was the first trailer that drops. I'm expecting J.J. Abrams going to show up personally to people's houses and give them a movie and make them watch it. And then the next morning, they might drop a trailer for it. That's how quickly these things are going. But ultimately, before we even get into whether the movie's good or not, I love the fact that there's no way to spoil this because you could just literally go watch it in front of everybody. This didn't rely on trailers or posters or news stories that they're generating that they you know, it's not, you're not going to run into things like, is this really about this? Oh no, it's not, but it really is. They were able to just generate buzz so quickly. So I kind of like the idea. I mean, I love the theater experience, but I love the idea of getting something brand new and at the feature film level. At home so immediately. Now, the movie itself, people then went bonkers on it because they're like, oh, this is terrible, this isn't fun, this is stupid, this is blah. You got to remember what the Cloverfield movies were. The first one was just a crappy found footage movie. Now, it was one of the first ones that kind of hit big, but it's still a crappy found footage movie. And it's a neat little kaiju movie, but the kaiju is sort of in the background through most of the movie. It's about the people running around. If the original Cloverfield were released today, it would be a flop and everyone would hate it. But it was innovative then. 10 Cloverfield Lane was really interesting, but ultimately that's just a kidnapping movie, really. It had some great performances in there and some good actors, but there was nothing more to it. And then this one is just, this is a dangerous stuff happens on a space station movie. And I love those kind of things. Stuff like Life that came out last year. I quite enjoyed that one. Or Alien, Haunted House on a Spaceship. And yeah, there's some stuff we've seen before, but that's kind of what made this movie so good is for me is that it was exactly, it exactly played into the kind of thing that I like. I love movies about people trying to do better for society and having it go disastrously wrong. And I love having that happen on a spaceship. These are the kind of movies I like. I like the idea that they're also like loosely connected. There's no real, there's already inconsistencies in the franchise, and they're not trying to make it into a standalone franchise. I think they just want to make it into Twilight Zone episodes. But ultimately, when it comes down to this movie, I think it kind of rocks, even though there are people who are expecting more from it when you really shouldn't. It's just a sci-fi movie.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quick about the box office. The only really notable thing about the box office, Winchester came in under $10 million last week, and that's kind of sad. That's, I mean, for the people involved in it, I mean, it wasn't a good movie, but the people involved in it, you would have expected something a little bit more. But then again, it's Super Bowl weekend. But the real surprise was just over 10 million, almost 11 million. Jumanji popped back up to number one. I don't know if that's like, that's rare for something to be off as number one for that long and then to pop back up. Usually there's a trajectory down, but there has been a remarkable hold for Jumanji. And I think that that's a lot to do with the fact that it has The Rock in it, has Kevin Hart. Both of those guys command a great audience and a very strong audience. And it's also just a fun movie, and there hasn't been a whole lot alternative out there. I mean, that's, I think, why it bumped up over The Maze Runner. And same thing with Greatest Showman. That's another one that's doing extremely well in terms of longevity. You know, it still made between 7 and 8 million last week, so that's not bad at all. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on War of the Worlds, the complete series. This syndicated show from the late 1980s serves as a sequel to the 1953 film about aliens invading Earth.
In 1953, Earth experienced a War of the Worlds. Common bacteria stopped the aliens, but it didn't kill them. Instead, the aliens lapsed into a state of deep hibernation. Now the aliens have been resurrected, more terrifying than before. In 1953, aliens started taking over the world. Today, they're taking over our bodies.
I never actually watched this, but it was at the time when they were starting to do a lot with syndicated programming, particularly sci-fi. And that's actually how Star Trek The Next Generation started. That was a syndicated program. There was also at the time these horror stories, like Freddy's Nightmares and the Friday the 13th series that were anthology series. And those were syndicated, and you just find them various places on the dial for various markets. So the War of the Worlds came out like that as well. And like those, there's an interesting thing to it because this is an interesting show to watch because it has all the trappings of an 80s show. But it also has one of those early syndicated feel to it where the acting's not very good and the writing's not very good. The video on this, it's really not a good transfer. I was reading up on it and it looks like they just released the discs again. They didn't actually do a new transfer to this. So it's actually a pretty low grade transfer because you're dealing with video from the late 80s. And even when they get into the second season, they don't even do a film look. They just go straight video. So it almost looks like a Doctor Who episode. But there's a certain charm to it because it does have a tip of the hat and a nod to the original 1953 film. So I think it has, I think that that's neat, that that's a neat connection. That stuff that's very popular now when they brought back Doctor Who, of course, they connected it and they did that with the X-Files and they connected. They're not just redoing movies, they're rebooting them and series. And this kind of rebooted the 1953 movie, which in its own right can be a little bit tough to watch at times in terms of pacing. But the second season just really kind of, they take a total change and kill off characters and they go, basically the first season and the second season are very different from each other. And the first season's a little better because it's a little more real world. The other one's sort of not too distant future. Overall, it's not a great series, but like I said, it's an interesting watch. And if you're a fan and you watched it, I'm sure if you caught this, even if it was garbage, you probably loved it, you know, because it's something maybe you watch as a kid. The War of the Worlds, a complete series. I'm going to say out of just the nicest of my heart, knowing that it has plenty of warts, it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Also out this week is A Bad Mom's Christmas, Suburbicon, Only the Brave, LBJ, and All I See Is You. And that is it for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Black Panther. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.